Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, as they say in England, let's give this another go. Let's try it once more. I didn't do it the first time. And let's see, 406. Sorry about that. Let me back this out. I dialed the wrong one. 802. Do space 2015. Let's see what I get this time in terms of dialing in. Did I get anything now? Nothing? I'm trying to dial into a number here. Let me try once more. Nope. Is it wrong? 802. 2015. Let's see if we're lucky on this one. It's ringing this time.
Yes. Hello?
Okay. Here we are. We're on. Yeah. We're on. Right. I'm doing two things at once. Okay.
Are you getting hit by that storm down there? Did you get a lot of flooding or anything where you are?
No, we have with blue skies, and I see some white clouds, a lot of sunshine, 82 degrees, wonderful
I'm
weather.
In the wrong
wonderful.
Place. I haven't I seen think... the mountains for over a week with the smoke. It's terrible.
Oh, wow.
Can hardly breathe.
So the smoke is visiting you, huh?
Oh, it's really bad, yes.
Wow. From all the fires in California?
California, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, I understand.
I
also understand we have some up the canyons as well. So I don't think we have any big ones,
but
there are fires everywhere.
Trump says that's not a problem with any of that. It's probably a figment of your imagination. He said everything is okay.
Well, you know what? If they let the fires burn in the past and they'd allowed logging and clearing in the forest, we wouldn't have such a bad problem now, but a lot of it, I mean, it's not just nature. There's a lot of it man-made, and there's a lot of it bad forestry. So,
wow, what a challenge.
Anyway.
What a challenge.
Yes, it is.
So you think, look, you've been around the planet a few years, right?
Yes, and a year or two.
And you're able to kind of see some things that most of us can't see, right? Because you've been here and out. What do you think? I mean, what do you think is happening? May I? And on the planet, something's happening. I mean,
on the planet itself. Well, we have this every year. It's a natural event, a planetary event about roughly every 50,000 years. The planet sort of geologically spring cleans itself and starts over. So
okay.
that's on average every 50,000 years. And some of it is a slow build up, but other events are very quick. They're very fast. You know, the planet can change things in a matter of days or weeks rather than years. So these geological changes are not necessarily over long periods of time. They can be very quick, and we're at one of those end of those cycles now. So nothing unnatural is happening. It's happened roughly every 50,000 years. Plus, in addition to that, you know, and I'm going to say this for Mr. Trump, because everybody's always knocking him. He is right about global warming. He really is. Because we are going to see a mini ice age. We're right on the brink of a small ice age coming to this planet. And it will be here in the next decade or so. Every winter is going to get worse and worse and worse, the winters, and then the whole northern hemisphere, which is slipping sideways a little bit because it's still moving, it's still in that polar movement. But nonetheless, what we think of typically as the northern hemisphere, the upper northern hemisphere, they're going to be like in an ice age. They're going to be frozen over. So we shouldn't be worrying about global warming. In fact, we should be glad we've got it, because it's probably the one thing that's keeping us from freezing to death right now.
Uh-huh. So, okay. All right.
So
all
I
right.
have to support Mr. Trump in that.
Okay. In addition to, I think you're going to vote for him if I get this whole feeling of what you're going to do. But you don't have to announce yourself. But I got a feeling that you want Trump in the White House. And if I may.
It is okay. Oh, okay.
Go ahead. You talk.
No, I'm listening.
No,
I'm
you
listening.
Talk. You talk.
Okay. It isn't that I want Mr. Trump in the White House. It's that I am 99.9% certain that if we don't get him back in the White House, we're going to be a whole lot worse off than with him. I know that's hard to imagine, because things are very unpleasant right now for everybody. Doesn't matter which side of the aisle you vote on. Everybody's having a bad time now. Republicans, Democrats, Socialists, Independents, you name them. They're all having a bad time. The whole planet is having a bad time right now. But I'm still I'm much more concerned about preserving some semblance of independence for us as individual people and as a nation than I am worried about whether I like Mr. Trump or not, or whether he wastes his time twittering or not. I mean, that to me is like way out there. But when you weigh the one against the other, we should all be very concerned. So here's what I would like you to consider, Russ. Right.
Okay.
First of all, Mr. Trump is the first, only in recent history, entirely independent, non-politician president. He is not a politician. Never has been, and really will never make a good politician, because he doesn't know how to play the game. But the game is crooked. And both sides of the aisle, there's an awful lot of crooked people in there, an awful lot of them. You're six of one and half a dozen of the other, let's put it that way. But when it comes to holding the line with policy, Mr. Trump's the first president we've had for a very, very long time. I want to say in living memory and more, who has held to what he said he would do, because he was not bought by any interests outside government. He wasn't bought by the big corporations before he got his presidency. He didn't buy his presidency. He won it, right? And so having said that, and keeping that in mind, that he is independent of the rest of the politicians, I mean, that's a big thing to have an independent man in the White House, because we've never had that before. Never, right?
Uh-huh.
Not since Eisenhower. I would say Eisenhower was fairly independent. And not since him have we had a truly independent. So whether you like him or not, that's individual choice. And whether you agree with what he does or not, that's also choice. But he has what he said he would done.
What's
and
that?
I don't believe, well, all the things that he has done with the economy,
like
with industry, with some, he's done a lot of things. I don't know all the different things. You'd have to go and look them all up, Russ. A lot.
But your friend sent you a list. Wait a minute. Your friend sent you a list from England the other day, which I didn't get yet. I really like to read that. And she was indicating that.
Oh, it was all the things that he hasn't done, or that he's done wrongly, I should say that. He's done them, but they didn't like it. The other side didn't like it. I'm sure Nancy Pelosi has a wonderful long list of all the things that she doesn't like. And I'm sure Bernie Sanders has as well. But two things concern me in this whole thing that I think we should all be thinking about very hard before we make a final decision. First of all, COVID. The whole COVID thing and all the economic disruption that's come with it is not our president's fault. And the question that everybody should be asking when they look at all the chaos worldwide that COVID has created, is two questions, really. The first question is, who in the world is powerful enough to pick up a telephone and make a call and tell every leader of every country, practically, even those that are fighting with one another and are sworn enemies, to pick up that phone and say, right, we want you to lock down your country, put all your people back to work, tell them to stay home and tell them they all have to wear a face mask and they can't go out and they have to stay 6 feet away from everybody. Now, who in the world has enough power to pick up a phone and make that call? That's a question that I would like an answer to. Absolutely. I think it's terrifying to me that somewhere in this world there is one person who was powerful enough to pick up the phone and tell the whole world, come to a standstill. And the second question I would like to have made public is, who most stands to gain financially from COVID? Who are the people who are going to be the big money winners in this game? And we know one of them straight off, and that's Dr. Fauci. And Bill Gates, of course, is his partner in one of the companies that produces the vaccines, right? So there we have two of them.
Okay.
Who else is going to make a lot of money? It's not going to be Mr. Trump. He's not making money out of all our inconvenience, that's for sure.
All right.
Now, I don't know about the others on the other side, but I know Mr. Trump isn't involved in that. That pure corruption.
All right. So, but, we have agreed that he's not politically astute, right?
No, he's not. In some things, it's like, how can he be so smart and so dumb at the same time? Some of the things he does. how could you do that?
Like drinking Lysol?
Yes. I mean, just some of the things he does are absolutely crazy, right? But I think that it's better that we have someone who does crazy things like he sometimes does, but doesn't have a vested interest nor a particularly intense left-wing ideology that is going to force down all our throats, because that's what's coming.
Okay, but in the Bible and other pieces of material, it says that what goes around comes around, right?
Right.
So Trump, when you're dealing with Russia, he seems to be, if I may, in bed with Putin. And I think because and that's going to come out one day, that there's hundreds of millions
of dollars. And what's wrong with, excuse me, but what's wrong with that?
Oh, okay.
Think about this. None of us like the idea of Russia because of communism and control, right? Those are the reasons that we don't like Russia. Communism, control, Stalin, Trotsky, Marxism. Isn't that true?
Okay.
Right. And
right,
yet, our left-wing Democratic Party is a Marxist party. Bernie Sanders is Marxist through and through. And every policy that they come out with, and everything that Nancy Pelosi and all her cohorts come out with, and all those extreme left-wingers in the Democratic Party, everything they come out with, they might as well have just read it out of Marx's book. It's pure Marxism. Now, Putin is a capitalist. Putin has the same monetary philosophy that we have.
Well,
and Russia, apart from one short period in Russia's history when things went very bad for them and they became communist and then they had to stop being communist. So you're talking about a whole span of less than 50 years of the whole mess, right? Apart from that, Russia has been a reliable ally of the West for hundreds of years, since the time of Catherine the Great. Russia has always been on the side of Britain and ultimately the US. World War II They opened up all their ports, they supported us without the Russian fighting on that front. Do you think that, who is it, our great general that we have here, Patton, would have been able to zip through with his panzers the way he did? No, he wouldn't. It's because Russia was holding the front, a third front, and keeping Germany occupied, right? So the idea that Russia is our eternal enemy, really and truly, historically, is a load of nonsense. It truly is. And if people want to make a study of history, they will find that if you want to become nationalistic, right, and talk about nations we should be friendly with or shouldn't be friendly with, the most traitorous nation to us throughout history, and I'm talking of Britain and the UK, the UK and America as being very connected, right? The country that's always given us the most political problems, aside from Germany after the Kaiser wanting to fight everybody all the time, the one that's always given us trouble has been France. France has been the most unreliable ally that anybody's ever had for 1,000 years. So, hey, if you want to just put big national things on it, read the history first. Understand the relationships between all these countries and how they stood and how long they stood.
All right.
If we're going to have to face off China, we need Putin on our side. We need to be in bed with Russia if we're going to hold off China in what's coming down on this planet. And believe me, when we get to that point, worrying about Nancy Pelosi will be small fry.
What do you think is coming down? How do you see things in the next?
Oh, I see. Ultimately, over the next 50 years, this planet will go back to the way it used to be at the time of Atlantis. Two halves. One half is the West. The other half is China and Asia. And China will be running the show. No question about it.
That's where we're headed.
No, there isn't.
Uh-huh.
Because nothing's changed. You know, humanity has the opportunity every so often to change its history. There is a collecting point of energy, you might say, a consciousness, where the whole consciousness sufficiently changes that you can turn a corner with it. You can turn history. And in the last 500 years or so, we haven't veered. And certainly in the last 100 to 200 years, we haven't taken any of those opportunities to change our future history. So I don't see how we can change it now, because we're past the point of no return. What we've been putting out for years is what we're going to get back. And I hate to say it, but this country, which I love very much, I love America, and I think it's a wonderful country and full of opportunities, or it used to be. Not so much now, but it used to be. But it's going to be on the losing end of the stick if it starts to move into socialism, left-wing politics. And the thing is, Russ, and I want to make this clear, I believe absolutely, and I've even been called a socialist, I believe in equality of all people, right? I believe in education. If a child is intelligent, it should be educated, and it shouldn't break the bank to do it. And I absolutely believe in healthcare for everybody. I think everybody's essential health should be taken care of. I think if you are very vain and you want a facelift, I don't think any health insurance should pay for that. You want cosmetic surgery for vanity, I think you should pay for it yourself. To me, that's no different than buying a car. But medically necessary healthcare, across the board, eyes, teeth, general health, I very strongly support some form of at least statewide or nationalized healthcare system. I'm a big, big advocate for it. But I'm still a capitalist, and I'm still a Republican. In the way they measure politics here, I would be, if I was voting, I would be a Republican voter and not a Democratic voter, because I'm not left-wing. And I'm not out-and-out socialist. They have a confused idea here.
But you say that about 1,000 times. You say left wing is evil, despicable, diabolical, nefarious.
No, they're your words. I've never used those words. I have never used those words. I think they are very mistaken. I think they are very mistaken. And I know for certain that those who are propounding those extreme left-wing ideas of control of people and control of nations and control of population are not learning from past history.
Okay.
And if we don't learn today from the mistakes of the past and correct them, we will relive them in the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if you don't know your history, you will relive the history.
Yes.
It's going to recur over and over and over again.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. But, all right. I want to get away from a minute or two of looking at 2020, where we are now, socially, economically, psychologically, philosophically, and spiritually, just for a second. And I'd like to step back for a minute and have you talk about, since you've been here 4,000 years, in and out, in and out, in and out, I could ask you once more, why do you keep coming back and forth, back and forth, back and forth? I mean, there's a reason that when you come to this planet, you live a life, you do what you have to do, you make your contribution, you study whatever, you can make whatever you do, and then you leave and you come back again. Why?
You're asking me why I come back or why anybody comes back?
No, why you come back. Look, there are other
why
places.
I come back.
No. Would you believe there are thousands, 10,000, 20,000, a million places to go in this vastness of the universe beside here? Would you believe that?
Well, that's true. But we also lock ourselves into planets. When we come, there are certain conditions that have to be met before we can be allowed to leave. It's like you have to have a passport before you can get on an airplane, right?
True.
So I have personal reasons for being here and not somewhere else at the moment. And let's face it, for me, if I'm being what I think of as my other self, right? If I'm being my other self, 4,000 years is only a year or so gone by. So it's no big deal for me to have been coming in and out for 4,000 years. What have I been doing for 4,000 years? Well, you know what they say, when you teach, when you need to learn, you teach, right? And
sure.
I've been coming in and out for the last 4,000 years trying to communicate whatever it was that needed communicating at the time I was on the planet. And sometimes it has been teaching about healing and herbs and medicine, and sometimes it's been teaching about the universe and mathematics. But everything I have done, I've done for two reasons. One, to try and help whoever I was communicating with in that life on this planet, and the other, to help myself at the same time by learning what I was teaching. You know, we learn when we try and teach other people, we learn. If I'm talking to you and I'm at the same time listening to what I'm saying, I'm learning from that experience, because afterwards I'll think, why did I say that? Is that really what I think about it, or would I think differently if I was answering the same question on another day? So as we put out information for supposedly the benefit of other people, we are actually benefiting ourselves, because we are learning from that process.
Okay.
And so for me, that's what I've been doing, coming, teaching, mm-hmm. learning.
All right. So you've been a nurse. You've been a seer, mm-hmm. or, you know, a clairvoyant for, 40 years, more, 50 years, 60 years. So, and you've been training and helping and guiding and directing people to a better thinking, a better way of life, right? Yes? Yes? May I say
hopefully,
yes?
Hopefully, yes.
Okay. And holding classes and helping people to reach a level of ascension. Is that you help them to even begin to think about ascending. Is that right? Yes?
Right. Right.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
All right. All right. All right. All right. How about the children who were born mixed with the Anunnaki and so the human beings, let's say, or the Dracos or the reptilians and humans? I mean, there is a mixture coming about, the hybrid. What about those
right.
kids? What could you describe those people and what role they're going to play in the future?
I would say that, you know, okay. Let me back up a little bit here. We are, by asking a question like that, you are making the assumption that the human race are the only humans, so to speak, and that every other sentient race out there is something different. In a some peculiar, let me finish this. Let me try and explain what I'm saying here.
Okay.
As if
all
they're
right.
completely, as if extraterrestrials are somehow different to Earth humans. So I would say stop around and look at our planet. On this planet, we have the red man, the white man, the black man, the yellow man, right? We have all these different races on this planet. But we're actually all the same. There's no difference between us. I'm no different to you. You're no different to a man in Beijing. He's no different to a man in Tokyo. We're all human beings, right? And just you have a variety of cultures and colors and things. That's to be expected. That's called diversity, right? But it's not difference. If you open somebody up in surgery, they pretty much all look the same on the inside. Some of us, because of strengths or weaknesses or environment, are more susceptible to certain illnesses than other people are. But that's just the variation mostly of location, right? And it's the same with the extraterrestrials. And the fact that they've advanced farther or faster than us in technology, so that they can come zooming in here on spaceships quicker than we could zoom out there on our spaceships, is really irrelevant. So if you take a couple in this country, let's say one who is one color and one who is another, right? And they marry and they have children. How are their children different? They're not. And so when these aliens that you're asking about, I might say I'm half Anunnaki, half human, but I'm no different to anybody else. Everybody on this planet today has Anunnaki DNA, a DNA, because the human species was genetically altered. And I am sure over the centuries, they have picked up some DNA from other species that have visited this planet for centuries. Not just in modern times. If you are asking me, well, first of all, as far as I know, the reptilian species have never had a breeding program with Earth humans. Not a breeding program. They have, however, the ability to shapeshift. And that's the danger with the draconians. They can shapeshift.
Okay, but they do have relationships with human beings all the time. The reptilians, they love it.
Oh, well, you know something that I don't know.
Okay, all right.
I don't know that.
You don't know that?
No.
Okay, all right. Well,
I mean,
okay.
I've seen that television show, you know, what was it called, V or something, right? And they were reptilians in human disguise, right? And in that context, yes, I'm sure that it's possible when they've shapeshifted themselves to look human. And then,
okay.
But actual reptilians as reptilians trying to breed with Earth humans, I've never heard of that. I know some of the species do. I know the Greys have always tried to have a breeding program.
Of course.
I know the Anunnaki have always had a breeding relationship
Absolutely.
With Earth humans. But
Absolutely.
I've never heard of the reptilians. So
you've never heard that?
Something,
never, ever?
No. So it's something I don't know anything about.
Okay. All right. But there are some crystal children, indigos, and all that that comes that are being developed between the children are part of that process of, be it the Greys, be it the Anunnaki, be it whomever, right? Is that right?
I don't know.
You don't know.
Hear a lot
okay.
of talk about this. And to say that it's true that children, I want to say more than just children, anyone under 35 today has a very high chance of being extraordinarily gifted and intelligent because they're coming to the planet born with a higher level of ability than
True.
Ever before in history, because they're ready for taking over the planet in a new age, which is
okay.
coming after 225, right? So
right.
I don't doubt that, but I keep hearing talk of, you know, and I do know that there are groups, which I think is unfortunate, who do take gifted children and train them and get them to do all kinds of things. But I can't say that I would ever be in support of that because
mm-hmm.
I don't think
mm-hmm.
it's natural.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, I was getting to, okay. All right. I got that. The Anunnaki. Could you go over that one more time, going back a couple hundred thousand years, when they first came here to get the gold to repair their own ionosphere? And then they decided to stay and create another world with the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Persians and all that. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. First, I want to preface it with, excuse me, my dates are probably wrong, right? Because it's such a long time ago. And I will try to keep the chronology in somewhat of order. But a very, very long time ago, when there were dinosaurs on this planet and you had this earth divided into two, and this is unimaginably a long time ago, you had the planet divided into two halves then, a northern and a southern half. And the southern half was Lemuria and the northern half was Atlantis. And the people on the island of Atlantis who came to be known down the line, the Anunnaki, were, of course, the Anunnaki living there in Atlantis. And the ones who survived Atlantis went to various places on this planet and continued their program of whatever they were doing. And when they got down to, they were in Egypt, of course, they went to Egypt. But long before Egypt and after Atlantis, that's the time period when they went to and found the gold in Africa. Now, originally, when they came to the planet, they intended to take the gold out of the ocean, right? But that mm-hmm. proved too costly, too expensive, didn't work well. So they started mining it. And after a very long time, hundreds of years, they guys who were doing the mining, who were actually the Anunnaki Air Force. It was like, you know, when we succumbed the military to fill sandbags, it was the same deal. The military people, the Air Force people, were made to dig for the gold. And eventually they went into a revolt. They rebelled. They said, we're not doing it anymore. We're slave labor here and we're fed up with it. And that had gone on for a very, very long time. And so that's when they developed the science laboratories down in East Africa and started the genetic engineering. Now, I don't know exactly when those experiments began. They may have begun up in Sumeria, I'm not sure. But I do know pretty well certainly that just over 400,000 years ago, that was when we went down into East Africa to look for the building site where the laboratories were going to be built to do the genetic engineering. And after those laboratories were built, the first genetic engineering proved to be a disaster. We ended up with a lot of unfortunate events, because we were trying to take the animal species, you know, like the monkey, say, and get them. We're trying to create a force of workers from the existing animals, much the same way as we harness horses to pull carts, you know, or we breed cattle to provide milk. They were looking for someone who would be able to go down the mines. And eventually, they developed this hybrid being who was part the female out of Africa and part the Anunnaki male. And they bred that creature to be sterile, to live for healthy, good, healthy life for about 800 years and then die a natural death. That was the intention. Well, of course, Enki, who was a master scientist, no doubt about it, but he couldn't resist tinkering. So he had a little tinker, and it wasn't just him tinkering. His elder brother, or his brother, the Enlil, who was living in Shemaria, he was demanding that he got some of these slaves for what he was doing in Shemaria at the time. He was developing ironworks and agriculture and all the other stuff, you know, that made a civilization. And he wanted some of the labor force to work there, and they were not being born quickly enough. So Enki gave the humans that they had developed the ability to reproduce themselves instead of being sterile. And once they started reproducing, they just reproduced like crazy. And there were so many of them, and they were running away. I mean, they would just pick up their bags and go, so to speak. And that's how the genes spread all over through the human species, right across the planet. They didn't stay confined to Africa and Shemaria, as was originally intended. They spread all over the planet. They escaped, they did whatever they wanted, and most of them became independent, quite separate from the Anunnaki, developing all over the planet. Which, of course, in Earth years then, became a pretty rapid dispersion of humans. And that went on from about, maybe 40,000 years before the Adam, the Adama, the biblical Adama. The biblical Adama was not the first man. It's a story about the first man, about him being made, right? But it was the Adama was the first man who had been educated, trained, and developed to take over control of the rest of the humans. That's who the real Adam was. Adam, in Anunnaki, Adam is simply a generic term for man or mankind, including both man and woman. And, you know, it's a generic term. And the first one's real name was Adapa. And Adapa was the one who was educated, trained, taught over a very long time. And it was about a 40,000-year gap between the first creation of the Adam to the time when, about 4,000 years ago, Adapa was handed over rulership. So it took a long time. It wasn't a five-minute job.
Now, when we look at, because, you know, some other sources say that when you look at the species, be it from the Pleiades or wherever they come from, that the people who were developed have a strong emotional core, wherein when we look at the Greys or, I guess, the Palladians or the Anunnakis or others, the Nordics who come here, Blue Avians, whatever, they don't have that strong emotional core as we find on the planet Earth. Is that true? Do you have any information
on that? Well, it's not true about the Anunnaki, I can assure you. They're a highly emotional. They wouldn't have had all the fighting and scrapping and wars they've had if they weren't highly emotionally charged. No, they're powerful emotional people. Very what we would call alive, you know, just communicating, They're very strongly emotional. They're highly sexual people. They love good food. It's no mistake, you know, that when they were hovering in their spaceships, right, and the humans started roasting meat down, it's, oh my gosh, the smell's coming up to us. Let's get down there after the flood and start feasting. It's no mistake. Every time they said, the first thing you do is plant a vineyard. Let's have some good wine going here. No, the Anunnaki had become through the eons of time a very sense-oriented group of people. And it is true at this point in history that I would say just approximately one half of the Anunnaki people wish to return to this planet and live on it full time. And the other half wish to go back to their state of origin, which was a very highly evolved spiritual state, and they want to get back to that. So you've got that division. There's one half of them saying, no, we've got too involved in the material. We've become too hedonistic. We are too much tied to the physical universe. We want to get back where we were. We want to get back into the light. And the other half want to say, they're saying, no, we love it here. We love the wine, women, and song, and we're coming back. So that really speaks for the Anunnaki. They are certainly high energy, very alive people, very alive.
So hedonism is not foreign to their existence, huh?
Oh, no. They're very hedonistic.
Okay. The other question is, the lifespan, it's much different than what the human being has today, you know, 60, 70, 80 years. The Anunnaki mm-hmm. has a longer lifespan, would you say?
Right. Yes.
Okay. Okay. How long can that be if you look at it? What do you
well,
think?
It can be forever.
Oh, okay.
You know, this is something I'd like to talk about for a minute, if I may, right?
Go ahead.
Another of my new books, right? I always seem to be getting new books thrown at me.
Okay.
Since we last spoke, somebody loaned me a book, and I mentioned it, I think, before, but I hadn't actually read it, called Saving Jesus.
Okay.
And it sounds as if it's going to be a very holy sort of book. But this writer, Michael Ledwith, Ledwith, mm-hmm. he is a brilliant scholar. Specifically, he's a Hebrew-Greek scholar, but he's got degrees in many subjects. And he spent a lifetime studying what went wrong with the teachings of Christ in the Christian churches across
okay.
the board, no one particular sect.
Okay.
And this book that he has written explains in great detail what the real message of Christ was. And I have to 100% agree with him, right?
Okay.
He's got it right. I mean, this man's really got it right, right? And it's like, thank goodness somebody understands, right?
Okay.
And there's some of the things that made it go all wrong are so unbelievably simple. For example, he says that back in, I think it was 1400 or something, whatever, it was an Archbishop of Canterbury at the time and in England. And he took an English translation of the Bible. And I must have my dates wrong because I don't think there was one then. But anyway, he took a translation of the Bible and he redivided it, verses and chapters.
He sure did.
And so some of the chapters that he divided have taken out of context everything that they're trying to say. This is primarily in the Old Testament. So when that question comes up of, does the Old Testament talk about the coming of Christ? Well, yes, it does. But the way you get it out of the Old Testament, if you read, for example, the King James Version, is entirely a warped and mistaken point of view. Because everything's been taken out of context due to putting half a chapter on one page and another chapter somewhere else down the line where it doesn't belong. So that was one of the great disturbances. But the other thing, and the most important, I think, and I'd like, if I may, to take a moment to explain this,
sure.
is that in the English language, we only have one word for love, and that's the word love. So we try to describe what kind of love we mean. We, you know, romantic love, sexual love, unconditional love. We have all these descriptions that never quite express it. And what this gentleman has done has, and he's written it in the book, you can actually physically see it with your eyes in many places. He's written the Greek word for love, and he's written the Hebrew words. He went back to original scrolls almost 2,000 years old, some of the scrolls, and retranslated. And apparently, most other nations in the world have many words to express love, the different kinds of love. And so, for example, and this one jumped out at me, there is a Greek word called agape, right? And agape means that total unconditional love, which is the creator, that love which is a state of being, not an emotion, not an experience, but a state of being, right? And he goes on to explain an interaction of Christ with Peter, when Christ is asking him. Now, if you read it in the Bible in English, it appears that Christ asks him the same question three times. Do you love me, Peter? Do you love me, Peter? Do you love me, Peter? But in fact, if you go back to the original, Christ doesn't ask the same question three times. He asks, do you have agape for me? Right? And when Peter says, well, I love you, Lord. Do you have agape for me? Well, I love you, Lord. Well, do you have philo for me? Now, philo is brotherly love, as opposed to, right? An entirely different thing. In other words, Christ was saying to Peter, I was asking him, do you have unconditional love for me? Are you on the same wavelength as me? Are you connected to me with the Father, right? Are we one? And Peter never answers that. Peter says, yeah, I love you. I'm your brother. I'm your friend, right? But he doesn't, in other words, Peter doesn't get it. He doesn't understand what Christ is talking about. So Christ gives up and says, oh, it's okay then. You've got brotherly love for me. That's fine. Let's carry on from there. When you understand that difference in understanding the translation, it totally shifts your point of view. And this book is 400 or 500 pages long. You have to be willing to really, really read it. But in the beginning, he starts out by explaining some of these things. Then he goes through pieces of human history, like the Anunnaki. He retells all the story of the Anunnaki, the Sumerian Enuma Elish, the ancient Egyptian stories of the Savior, blah, blah, blah. And then he comes to his conclusions, to the reason he's writing the book, which is just wonderful. It's so wonderful. I wish I could tell the whole world about this, because he then says Christ's real message was not, you are a victim and you are a fallen race, have been damned forever since the Garden of Eden. Quite the reverse. You are wonderful beings who can, as I have told you, do what I do. My Father is your Father. You can do everything I can do and more. And Christ says that over and over again. And what he's talking about is becoming a totally immortal being, as Christ is, a being who can create a body at will, a being who never dies. Now, think about this. We don't have a problem accepting that Christ appeared to his disciples after he'd been crucified, right? And they put him in a tomb and he came back again. And then he sits down and eats with them. He has a meal with them. In other words, he's showing you can destroy this body and you can recreate it at will. And this is what he's trying to explain to everybody is possible for them. That you're not condemned. There's no such thing as, you know, a brand new baby born. What sin do they have? They don't. And I've been screaming this all my life. Get away from the idea of sin, because it's nonsense. Get away from the idea that you're condemned from the moment you're born because some idiots in the Garden of Eden became sexually aware and were so ashamed. And so for 4,000 years later, you're going to get punished, right? That is the most misunderstood piece of nonsense. But what it's done, it's allowed the religions of the world, the Christian religions, to convince people that the only way that they can get past that is if they spend their lives groveling about in churches on their knees, begging somebody to forgive them.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't need forgiveness because there is nothing to be forgiven. They were mm-hmm. not condemned. So what they have to do is start working on correcting themselves, not yes. as victims begging somebody else to save them, but get busy correcting their own character, correcting their own faults, putting themselves in conjunction with the teachings of Christ, not the church, but Christ, right?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually evolving to that state of agape, that state of pure unconditional love, where they and the Father are one, like Christ was, right? And then they are immortal beings. And this is out there for everybody. And the wonderful thing about this book, Saving Jesus, is that he explains what Christ taught and how Christ taught you how to do this. And then he explains it in modern language, exactly how to do it. And he said the problem for people today is not that they might have become enlightened enough to understand everything I'm saying right now. And there are millions of people who do, right? It's not just me who understands this, right? But more than that, we all of us have a conscious mind and a subconscious mind. And whether we like it or not, our subconscious is programmed with race memory. And for 2,000 years of race memory, the Western churches of Christianity have been teaching us, drilling into us at our deepest subconscious level, that we're born sinners, and the only way we can be saved is by some belief that they decide and that they tell us we have to believe, right? And service to them, service to the church. And so we have to learn how to undo that subconscious programming, which is obviously in the subatomic field. It's in the quantum field of our existence. And we have to change it in that quantum field so that it gets through to our subconscious, and then our conscious mind can take control of our lives and our potential immortality. And what I love about this book is that this gentleman has done the research, has the scholarship, and explains it all in language which we can actually understand. And he has given everybody who reads that book, if they bother to really read it and make the effort to do the work, he's given everybody an actual intellectual key to their own immortality. It's amazing. It's an amazing book.
So Saving Jesus by Michael, L-E-W-I-T-H, right?
L-E-D-W-I-T-H, Ledwith. And Michael... Yeah, L-E-D-W-I-T-H, Ledwith. And
okay.
Michael is spelt M-I-C-E-A-L. There's no,
no
H in it. No, M-M, I think it's M-I-C-E-L. I think it's a European spelling of the name. It's not your average English spelling of
okay.
Michael. But the last name is Ledwith.
Ledwith.
And the
okay.
book's called Saving Jesus.
Well, I'll go to the Amazon and get it. Maybe it's an audio, because a lot of stuff is in audio, and that would be nice. Because when I was recommending you the one by Dr. Saylor, and
yes,
go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
No,
the
I
one
said,
you asked.
I got the audio and I got the book itself, so I had both.
Oh.
So,
yes.
So as I walk around, I can always listen to. For instance, I just finished I'm listening again to The Pleiades and Our Secret Destiny by Frederick Dodson.
Yes, you mentioned that to me, and I did buy it, and I am reading it, and I think it might be a good, probably going to be a good book for beginners. The way it's written, it's not what I would call scholarly, but it's a nice read, and I think it would be helpful to a lot of people who are beginning their inquiries.
But a lot of people don't know those constructs, so I would like to do a show with you on that, you know, for you to explain what you derived out of that book, what you discern, right?
Yeah.
You say it's basic. Okay. You say it's basic, but it's not basic to us. For most human beings on this planet, it's not basic. Talk about the Pleiades.
Well, it's a nice book. I mean, it's a nice book to read, right?
Okay.
It's a storybook, right?
Right. Okay.
The man's
okay.
telling you some nice stories, and that's good. It's a good introduction to what's going on.
Okay. Now, when we looked at the Galactic Command, there's a non-interventional process. I mean, they have said you don't kind of get involved in the political, economic, social, and psychological development of the human being. We help when we can, but we are not allowed to intervene and push you to a certain level. Is that where we are in terms of that statement?
That is a true, that's a true statement. Non-interference with the life stream of another is a universal statement, and it applies in both personal private life, and it applies in galactic situations as well.
Right.
Non-interference is the rule.
So as a clairvoyant and as a seer, I can't ask you what the lottery number is next week then.
If I knew, I would play them, and then I'd be too busy to talk to you. I was going to say I'd be off on a cruise, but I wouldn't, would I? With COVID, I'd still be pinned down at home.
Pinned down at home. So, George, he did a lot of research and a lot of work when he was here.
Yes.
Do you think when he left, he was pleased that he had, for 40 years, 50 years or more, had delved into all of this? And again, for people who are listening, you can always go to the website www.nohoax.com, and a lot of his information is right there. And then you can always go to YouTube and punch up George Green and listen to what he has to say. Do you think he was satisfied at 80 years old that he had completed much of what he was sent to do? Do you think?
Well, first, I have to tell you, he didn't want to die. He was. He said, oh, I think I should be staying a lot longer than this. I have more things I want to do. So, I think they pretty much snatched him off the planet. And I think that they probably snatched him off because they knew that book was coming out of Dr. Sellers, Murray Orsic in it. Her photograph, that would have really upset George. And I'm sure that whatever he's doing now, he's taking it in his stride. But and he understands why that was the way it was. But I'm sure if he'd still been here on the planet, he would have been extremely upset about that. He would not have been a happy camper. As it was, when he left the planet, he'd enjoyed his life, he'd enjoyed his work, he'd enjoyed everything he had done. He loves the human race. George genuinely loves people. He's a real people person, always has been. And he really, really, truly, you know, most of, I was going to say most people who do work like he did, they make a lot of money out of it. Most of them, not most, a lot of them do. But
true.
George never did. George funded himself everything that he did. He used to work 12, 14 hours a day making money so that he could afford to go to all these places and do all these lectures. And it was only, you know, when they were big conferences that maybe the people running the conference would pay your air ticket or give you accommodation at the hotel. But even when they were paying speakers, when he would go to, you know, a big group, maybe a couple of hundred people, from some organization wanted him, and they were willing to pay him because they sold tickets. He would never let them sell the tickets for more than $10.
Wow.
I think the most he ever sold, if I remember rightly, and this was some years ago, and it was a group, if I remember, back in New Jersey. And they'd invited him to go, and they would pay his airfare, and he was to stay with one of the people. And he was doing a lecture and a workshop. It was like an evening and a day or something, if I remember, maybe a Friday night and a Saturday or something. But, you know, 12, 14 hours of his time was going into it, actually, when he was there. And he let them charge $20.
I see.
And that's that's the only time they charged. Mostly they were groups who didn't pay anything. And some of them were, you know, just one group. He got off in the middle of one of our cruises, left the ship 4 days early to fly somewhere because this nice little group of, and it was just a small group of people, maybe 20 people. But anywhere that he could get, if people asked him, he would go. And at least 80% of it was on his own cost.
Yeah, he wanted to disseminate the information.
He wanted to help.
He wanted to help people
because he knew what was coming down, like so many of us do. You know, for years we've known what was coming, and wherever people would listen, George would go and tell them and try and help them. And the help went on long after the lectures as well. Our phone at home never stopped ringing when George was alive. People were calling him all the time. They'd call him all hours of the day and night. I used to get cross sometimes and tell him, hang up. You know, you don't need to talk to all these strangers all the time. Hang up, right? But, no, George was available for anybody any time. Six in the morning till midnight, right?
Yeah.
He never said no.
Yeah, that was excellent.
He was a wonderful man. He was a wonderful man, was George.
Right.
There aren't many like him.
I got you. Very knowledgeable in terms of the economic wherewithal, how to be an entrepreneur. He did very well back in the day. You know,
he did.
He did.
He was very successful, a very successful businessman.
Extremely
and he was well-educated. Well-educated man,
right,
across a broad field. So
true, that's true. Yeah, he had a lot of knowledge about the state of affairs, if you will. Look, as we come down to the bewitching hour, Saint Germain, how important was he to help those individuals in 1776? Put together the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights and all of that. Francis Bacon back in the day when they were trying to pull that all together.
Francis Bacon, brilliant man, been in and out of human history many times, right? Great friend of Will Shakespeare, just a darling man. He really was a wonderful man. Now, when you're talking about Saint Germain, people always tend to say Saint Germain, as if they think that Saint Germain is the same as, you know, Saint Peter, right? Or Saint Monica or whoever, right? So I want to be loud and clear about this. The saints with names, Saint somebody, that are in the Catholic list of saints, right? Well, there is never has been a Saint Germain. There is no such saint as Saint Germain. The person they are referring to was Saint Germain, right? The French person. That was his name, Saint Germain, like Sault-Saint-Marie, right? town of Sault-Saint-Marie, right? He was Saint Germain, right? A French nobleman. And he was a black occultist. And his main occupation in life was seeking after the philosopher's stone to turn dross metal into gold. He was the least saintly person you're ever likely to meet.
I see.
He was a black magician who was focused on creating gold, seeking the Philosopher's Stone and to turn joss metal into gold. And he was a famous occultist, but he was also, as you rightly say, mixed up with the independence and the French Revolution and all that good stuff. But he wasn't a saint.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right. But they said he was very instrumental in helping to pull all of that together. So
there was a lot of power. He was a big power broker.
Okay. Now, Francis Bacon, some say, you say he was a friend of Shakespeare.
Right, Will Shakespeare.
Others have said that he was the illegitimate son of the Queen. Have you ever heard that?
No, I've never heard such a thing, and I don't. It's not true. That's not true.
All right. Yeah,
I knew Francis Bacon very well.
Oh, you did?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Could you describe him? Could you tell what part he played in history for those people who don't know him?
Well, he worked very closely with the Queen and for the Queen, and he was what you might call frequently an undercover agent on her behalf, right? And his personality was very extrovert. You know, like we have the modern James Bond, right?
True,
right?
Yes.
Flashing about all. Well, Francis was kind of like that. He was kind of like a 16th century James Bond type, but he was a very close and dear friend of Will Shakespeare, and he did actually write most of the soliloquies in the Shakespeare plays. He would come over to the house and write the soliloquies. So he was brilliant. And he is still very powerful, and he works a great deal from the other side now. He's not in incarnation at the present time, I can assure you of that. He is working, however, from the non-physical side very closely. And in fact, my dear friend who died some years ago, he was to her like the one I call David is to me. He was with her his whole life, and he used to turn up in her bedroom in the mornings and give her information. And I used to spend quite a bit of time staying with Edna up in Yorkshire. And he would suddenly appear in the bedroom in his 16th century dress, you know, with his slouch hat with the big feather in it, and his soft doeskin boots with the big turnovers and his tunic. And he would march up and down in the room telling her poetry, just reading poetry. He was a brilliant poet, but he would also tell her about information, global information, much like David's always told me. He would tell her the stuff, and he always came when I was there.
I see.
So I saw him there frequent. I mean, he would manifest very powerfully, so it wasn't like looking at shadow or light or anything. It was just as if a person had stepped into the room. Brilliant.
Did you have any in-depth conversation about he and what he was trying to accomplish even today on the other side? Did you have any conversation with him?
Oh, that's so long ago. I don't remember what we talked about. But I'm sure we did, because he would stay for an hour or more sometimes. And I can tell you, when Edna died, she came right back to me, and she was the one who warned me of a big earthquake that will eventually, I told you about it once before when we spoke about Chernobyl. And she was the one who, she showed me a newspaper, and on the back page where they have all the stocks and shares listed, it was as if all the ink was running. And I said, "What is this you're showing me?" And she said, "New York will be flooded to a depth of 8 feet because of that." David had recently told me about the Chernobyl earthquake that was coming. And she came and showed me this, and she said, "And remember, when it hits, it will completely crash the stock market." Because, and I didn't know this then, but she told me, she said, all the computers, they run the stock market with, are underground. They're all in the basements.
I see.
I mean, I'm going back now. She died in 1982, so this is about 1984. She was telling me this.
Okay. So you are able to communicate with people who have crossed over as a seer, as a clairvoyant. You can get information from the other side. Is that right? Is that where we are?
Right. Right.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Are they telling you anything about what's coming up in terms of 2025?
No. Not anything that I haven't already told you in the past. The only thing that they're telling me now, and they keep coming on a regular basis saying, Jillian, have some patience. The new work starts soon. The new work starts soon. And I have a very powerful impression that when they're talking about the new work starts soon, it's going to be this October. I know the election isn't until November, but I think we're going to see major events occurring middle to late October. I honestly don't know what they are yet. It's just I have this very nervous feeling almost that we better be ready to stand our ground. We better be secure in ourselves and in our environment by the second half of October. Yes.
Well, the election is 11/3/2020. So
yeah, I know. I know the election's not till November, but I think there are going to be major events and
well,
not necessarily good.
But that's the same as October. I mean, look, 11/3 is what? Come on, hello. Right after October.
No, I am talking about everybody is telling me, I mean, all my friends and people who know stuff, they're telling me, oh, right after the election, there'll be this and this happening. I am thinking that there's going to be some major disclosure that's going to change history.
Well, what do you
think it will be? In the last 2 weeks of October, before the election, there's something coming up. I feel sure there's something. I could be wrong. I hope I am, because it's not making me feel good, I can tell you that. And if I should get direct information about what it is, I will call you and tell you. But nobody's telling me. But the guys are warning me, have patience, new work starts soon. And I know the new work is going to be to do with the rehabilitation of the human race. I know that's the work that's coming up.
That's big.
I can't imagine what's going to happen before the elections that is going to radically change things. But I really am very wary. I'm watching that, especially anytime 12th of October on.
Okay.
From the 12th of October, and especially that date, the 12th of October. But I would say 12th to the 17th, 20th.
Before the election, though. So you don't think, from my sources that I'm talking to, they say that it's not even a question that Trump won't be elected. Trump will be elected president of the United States on 11/3.
He's supposed to be.
No. My sources say it's guaranteed.
Yeah.
Is that over? They said because the people off planet want that to happen.
Yes.
Why would they want that to happen? The people off planet.
Because he defends the American Constitution, and the other side are shredding the American Constitution.
Okay.
And it is intended that this whole planet, or at least the northern hemisphere half of the planet, the western half, you might say, will be run by the American Constitution. All the off-planet species are agreed. The Galactic Council, if you like, have agreed that the document which will be used to lay down the foundation for the regeneration of humans on this planet will be the American Constitution, because they agree that that is the greatest document that has ever been written for the government of men.
Okay, but didn't they have some input into that? Did that come together?
Well,
that
of
document?
course, Of course they did.
That's why they wedded to it. Okay, all right.
But it is a phenomenal document. You know, we keep distorting it, and maybe you can question some of the things that are amendments or whatever, but the actual original document and the Bill of Rights, that's a phenomenal document. Nobody
okay.
else has that.
True. All right, well, we got that down, Pat, that so I can take all the bets in the world that Donald Trump will be president of the United States. Oh, by the way, did you hear him the other day? He says, after I win this election, the people of the United States should give me another 4 years after that because you've been so against me and putting me down and criticizing me and all this, so you should give me another 4 years after that to finish my job.
I will tell you something, that because the planet is running 20 years behind schedule, everything that's happening on the planet is 20 years behind schedule. So all the chaos, all this terror stuff around the world, which since COVID, we don't seem to hear about. Our latest terror is COVID, right? But all this, you know, wars and rumors of wars and everything else that's been going on, that was supposed to have occurred in 2020 been finished and done with by 2015 in the global plan for this whole planet. So now we should be 5 years into the rehabilitation and reorganization program, so that when we got to 2025, we'd have everything running on an even keel and move into the new cycle with something like a degree of stability, instead of which we are in total chaos. And the bad guys are using this total chaos to take advantage and try and get control of the world through the excuse of COVID. Put your face masks on, don't speak to anybody. They've broken down the nations, they've divided the people, and now they're dividing the individuals one from another. You have to be at least 6 feet apart. Now, understand what this means, right? If somebody actually sneezes, the droplet infection from a sneeze can actually travel dozens, if not hundreds, of feet. Right? It goes a long, long way. Separation isn't going to cut it. But what 6 feet separation does is actually pretty well ensure that nobody connects energetically with anybody else. Because the energy field that you put out goes on average 1 to 2 feet out from your body. So if you're always 6 feet away from somebody else, you're never going to interact. Now, they stopped you speaking to them and smiling at them. You can't talk easily because of your mask. You can't smile at anybody. There's no point because they can't see you smiling. And you can no longer sense how anybody's feeling because your energy field is not touching anybody else's energy field. So they have created a situation of total isolation for all the individuals who are obeying this. What they have done with this COVID is so wrong and so terrible and so stupid, because it's not scientifically valid. Any virus, unless you're wearing a full hazmat suit, any virus can get through a face mask. And
yeah,
if somebody actually sneezes or coughs in your vicinity, 6 feet's not going to make any darn difference one way or the other. There is no actual scientific validation for what they are doing. I don't care how many people they pay. And one wants to ask oneself, all these scientists that they have out there telling you to do all these things, how many of them are in debt to medical schools that are paid for by Big Pharma, or actually work for and even are spokesmen for Big Pharma? And Big Pharma is one of the cornerstones of our military-industrial complex, which is run by the Nazis from World War II, who are now controlling all our industry. So you're actually obeying the Fourth Reich. You're in the same situation as the people were in Germany when the brown shirts were running around reporting on people for not doing as they were told.
Okay, did you get that from Dr. Sala?
I got that because I know that's true. No, he did say some of that, actually. He did talk about that, if I remember rightly. But he doesn't mention it as Big Pharma. I just happen to know that.
Okay. Yeah. So, there's a lot of documentation on what you just said. A lot of people just don't know it.
I'm sure there is because it's the truth. You know, there's bound to be millions of people out there who know it's the truth, but they're afraid. Everybody is afraid. And that's what we're coming down to. How many of us are going to be strong enough to stand up for what we know is the truth? And for me, my stand up will be when they try to give me an inoculation, one of their vaccines that are making money for Fauci and Gates and several dozen other big families that are all evil, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, they're the personification of evil, and they're going to try and mandate the taking of these vaccines. Well, they'll mandate it for me over my dead body because I won't do it. I don't care if they put me in jail, if they don't let me buy and sell, because I won't have them. I will not allow them to put nanobots into my system through a vaccine. Well, I will not do it.
I think they lean in that direction, from what I gather, that they would want to. But they would like to get rid of about 7.5 billion people off this planet anyway, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Replace us with artificial intelligence.
Yep. AI takeover. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, listen, as we close, let's talk about something briefly that...
Cheerful. Something cheerful.
Right. The time on this planet that people are here and they're afraid to ascend or transition, right? Because they think something is demonic or sinister on the other side. So we have that fear of death. Could you talk about that a bit so people can be a little more comfortable as we get to down?
First of all, I think I already talked about it at great length with this Saving Jesus book, because I am telling you, and I'm telling everybody out there who's listening, if they actually understand that book, and it's very easy to understand if you read it carefully, right? It's not brain surgery. You don't have to be brilliant. It's simple language. And it's the important pieces are only a few pages that you can keep reviewing till you get it. If you actually follow those instructions and pay attention, this could be your last time on this planet. Absolutely. Because it's telling you the truth in simple language, and not just telling you what the truth is, but how to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are afraid of dying, read that book and you'll never have to die again.
So that's
think
a must
about
read.
That. That's all. Tote is the most, I think, for information, that Dr. Michael Sala book is a should read and be informed, right? But this particular book, for me, if you're a human on this planet and you don't want to do the reincarnational bit except by choice, and you want to choose to come back to the planet and not have to be reborn, but just step off your little spaceship and help people and step back on again, or even just materialize in a body when you need one, like the Lord did himself, right? This book actually tells you how to do it. It's the how-to book of immortality. It's an amazing book because he's made it so simple. And everything he is saying in there, I know, is true.
Wow.
This is not some made-up fairy story or somebody having an out-of-body experience or wandering off into their own imaginary fairyland. This man is a brilliant scholar who's devoted a lifetime to actually understanding and explaining what these ancient documents really said and what Christ really taught. And
so
it's amazing.
Do you think he's on the same level as Sitchin's? Would they have a good conversation together?
I'm sure they would. Yes, I'm sure they
okay.
would.
Okay. Because he delved into this Sumerian civilization and all that. So, yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So,
I love Sitchin's books.
What book would you recommend at Sitchin's, that if you had to
recommend Sitchin's. A book? The first, start at the beginning and read The 12th Planet, the book called The 12th Planet. Mm-hmm. It's a captivating story. If you're really not interested, but you just want to get some general background information about the Anunnaki connection with Earth, and you don't want to read all Sitchin's books, then there's one a smaller paperback book that he wrote called The Cosmic Code.
Uh-huh.
And that's a fast read, and it's a very interesting little book because he put together the main bits of information from all his previous books. He just compiled it all into one, like a Reader's Digest version. So if you want to know about the Anunnaki, start with The 12th Planet. But if you just want a general information, background information, then get the little one called The Cosmic Code.
And that's a quick read, quick, fast, and in a hurry. Okay.
Now, yes, a couple of hundred pages.
Okay. So that can be gotten on the website, www.nohoax.com. I'm sure it's there.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay.
I'm sure.
Well, thank you very much for everything that you've shared with us. So that maybe it uplifts the spirits of a lot of people who are totally confused these days. But
don't ever be afraid of dying, because dying here is like coming out of a terrible disease. And when you're born onto the other side, it's like arriving in a luxury resort. If you compare the two, it's incredible.
Well, the people
it's so wonderful.
That's what the people who have said the near death experiences, the people who have gone over and come back because for one reason or other, that's a real deal, isn't it? Is it not? When they talk about okay. Take 1 minute and talk about that as we close. 1 minute and talk about those experiences. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. The light, some people say it's from the brain when you die. Some people say it's, you know, you go down the dark tunnel and there's the light waiting for you. What I want to say is the truth, right? The truth is that when you actually physically die with a great deal of oxygen in your brain at the moment of death, like people who have a road accident or, you know, suddenly die or are on a hospital oxygen machine, there is a large amount of oxygen still in the brain. So you stop breathing, your heart stops, but there is a huge flash of light in the awareness which hasn't yet left you. And that awareness can come first and foremost from the amount of oxygen that's still in your brain at the moment of death. That is brilliant light. And then comes the light from the other side. And in the 23rd Psalm, it talks about the valley of the shadow of death. Well, the valley of the shadow of death is literally like a band of darkness, and you're on one side of it, and there's the brilliant light on the other. And all you have to do is think, I want to go to that light. If indeed you want to go to the light. Many people should realize this, that you're just as much in control of your spiritual body as you are now of your physical body. It's still you, right? So you might be thinking to yourself, well, I've just died in that bed, but I really don't want to leave yet. I want to make sure all my family come and have a good cry before I go. And I might just want to hang around and see my funeral and see who turns up at my funeral. People do think like that. And sometimes they like to stay around, as my darling George did. He stayed around me for a year, more than a year, right? He left. But he kept coming back. He left, but he kept coming back because he wanted to know that I was going to be okay on my own. And he didn't leave until he felt that I was independent. Now, he has come back again since with bits of information. I'm sure he's never going to lose touch. But predominantly, he's not hanging out around me all the time like he did that first year. He was hardly gone, right? So this is your choice. Once you die, you're done with that. It's like you've traded in your old car. And now you're out there and you haven't decided what you want for a new car. But when you decide then to move yourself through into the light and meet all your other friends that are already there or the people that you're wanting to see and your guardian angels, guides, counselors, they're all there. The place is pretty full, right? And mm-hmm. It's wonderful. It's incredible. Light like you have never seen in your life. You know, we hardly see those blue skies, but if you're as old as me, you can remember the days when there were clear blue crystalline skies, and there is that shining, scintillating color on the other side. Everything shines, everything's like gems, like shining like diamonds and precious jewels. The light scintillates, and it really is like that.
Wow,
it's beautiful.
Wow.
And okay. Then there are so many different locations, and you, in consultation with your guides, your friends, your helpers, will decide where it is that you want to spend your time there. You might want, you can be making your plans. I have my plan. I have my intent. I know exactly what I'm going to be doing as soon as I get to the other side. And it's very exciting, and it's very wonderful, and there's nothing to be afraid of, nothing.
Okay,
Being dead is a great state to be in, and sometimes I think it's better than being alive.
I hear that. Okay, well, we appreciate you. Well, thank you very much for words of encouragement, enlightenment, and especially the book, Saving Jesus. I have to pick that up.
Yes.
Thank you.
Very powerful.
Great.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. And you have a good one and take care. And I'll close with George. Take care. Have a good one now. Thank you.
On Good Morning America. No,
great.
But it's just showing that there is conscious. And
we
know that. I mean, it's
animals.
Chris Birds with the when he did his stuff on the talking to the plants. You know, that ET group down in Brazil that were plants, look like humans, but chlorophyll based.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got that salve. I still have that information for curing cancer. And so, you know, the game becomes very, you know, just exploring. I love the exploration of what the universe is all about. I'd be glad to, you know, take off and go to other planets and explore and do things. But that's not my job at this point, is to try to awaken and save the remnant. Does it look good? No. But I'm going to keep trying and say I'm not failing because I'm doing my job.
You definitely are doing your job, George Green.
is it going fast enough?
Let me ask you one thing about the time in Atlantis. Sorry, have you been told anything about, you know, that we've been through this again,
yes,
in the past as an Earth and as a people?
Sure. My wife, who's a clairvoyant, remembers the total time of Atlantis, Lemuria.
And when they went from Atlantis and the destruction of Atlantis,
all of that.
And they
she
went
can
to
tell
Egypt.
You all, yeah, she can tell you the whole thing and who was in charge and how it all happened, and we're going to go through the same thing.
Okay.
But there's something to look at. It's okay to look back. Don't stare.
Okay, that's interesting, yeah.
No, seriously.
Right.
You can get caught up in what is there. And remember what I told you in the beginning. The only thing that exists is right now.
Okay, great. Thank you. And thank you very much, and have a good one. And see you next time right here on Blog Talk Radio. Bye now.